Hello and welcome to The Cinephiles, where the season of Scorsese continues. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roque. I'm a writer, producer, and host and voiceover guy over here in San Diego, California.
And we thought in between this break, between Goodfellas and Raging Bull, we've done a live show on Color Money. Hope that you enjoyed it. We had a fantastic, fantastic conversation. Yeah. And we're also going to re-release what is, did you know, by the way, John, that Taxi Driver is the second two-part episode ever done by the Cinephiles?
No, I did not know that. Wow.
We did it, yeah, we did it right after Citizen Kane. And it was so funny because we had talked about it when we did Citizen Kane, like, okay, well, this is going to be a multi-part episode, but we'll probably never do that again. I mean, it's just Citizen Kane, right? And then we get into Taxi Driver, and there was so much to talk about that it was just like, I guess this is going to be two parts.
Well, I could argue that this is a seminal film because of that reason. Doing it once can be an anomaly. Doing a second time means that we're changing the show, and this might have been the second film that kind of, or the spark rather, as the second film that caused us to look at the possibility of doing multi-part episodes. Because I know that's something that we weren't necessarily 100% sure the fans would enjoy, but we have discovered they have enjoyed, for certain films, our deep, deep dives into each section of these movies. And it's great that we're kind of re-releasing this again for people to have another discussion about this movie. And especially Steve, as politics are ramping up again in our country, re-releasing Taxi Driver, which focuses on a political campaign going on, and a person who is a little bit unhinged about the whole situation, is some good timing here for the re-release of this film.
Well, I mean, at the time that the movie was made, politics were super controversial. There was so much chaos in the world. There was violence growing in the street. There was huge divisions. And yeah, we're kind of right back there. And it's interesting, too. Like, you know, obviously a film like Lawrence of Arabia is 3 hours and 45 minutes long. It's going to take a long time to go that through that film. Right. But there's also, it's not just, and this is, I think, one of the things that's great about doing The Cinephiles that I really loved, is that a commentary track has to exist in exactly the same length of the film.
Yes.
And if you talk for 5 minutes, then you missed 4 minutes of something else that maybe you should have talked about. Right. And the thing about a movie like Taxi Driver is every moment can be analyzed, because there's so much going on with this person.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult. Like, does he think this or does he think this? Why is he doing this? Is he real? Like, I remember you brought up a thing which I had never occurred to me, which is that when he's calling Sybil Shepherd on the phone after the bad date, you brought up the idea that he's not even talking to her, that it's entirely in his head. Yeah. And I went, holy shit. And that totally changes the way the movie goes. And that's why this ends up being two parts, because everything that's going on, there's something to analyze.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. And that's what's so fun to revisit these films since we started our show, is that I watch these films now with a completely different mindset than I did when I first watched them, which is to enjoy them and appreciate them and grasp the things that I could get. Now it's like, well, what could be happening here that I'd never thought about? What could be a new interesting thing that could be happening here in this film that you can make a case for? And I love that when we both discover those things when we watch these films and have conversations about them, because I think that it helps us to enjoy the film all over again in new and interesting and fun ways. So I appreciate you bringing that up, and certainly enjoyed this conversation that we had and exploring what Travis Bickle's motivations are, and especially that ending. What happens at that ending? What is Scorsese trying to say with that ending? Now looking at it all these years later, what is that red all about? Is Sybil Shepherd even in his cab? I love that we can have these conversations about exploring what's real and what isn't real, because in a way he's the protagonist, but he's an unreliable protagonist. So how much of what he's doing is actually happening or not happening, which is a fascinating way to see the movie.
Well, and this is what's so exciting about doing these seasons of a director, because we just get to go from masterpiece to masterpiece. Goodfellas, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver. I'm not saying Color of Money is a masterpiece. That's not the point. That was just a fun conversation. But like, and each one of these films, Goodfellas, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, they are so different. And yet they are all Scorsese films. They're 100%. They have his brand just baked into them. And so without further ado, we are very happy to take you back to the streets of New York, the hard streets of New York, and Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Hi, everyone. This is Steve. Jumping in just for a moment to say that the film we're reviewing today, Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver, might be a classic of 70s cinema, but it is definitely not a movie for the whole family. In our discussion, we get into some topics which some people might find difficult or even offensive. Still, we think this film has as much or even more to say today than when it premiered over 40 years ago. So, without further ado, let's dig deep into Martin Scorsese's 1976 film, Taxi Driver.
All the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies. Sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all the scum off the streets.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, we explore its themes, its history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I am a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, host, writer, producer, all that jazz here in California and Los Angeles. And we are recording on my contraption.
That's right.
This episode. So I'm like super worried that it's not going to come out the way Steve likes it, because Steve is so precise about the editing. I don't mean in a negative way. I mean a positive way, because you guys know who've listened to our episodes. Steve edits our episodes. He puts in the clips, makes sure the audio is on point. So it's kind of unnerving to make sure this gets all right, because I want the episode to sound great. And we're doing this in the rain in Los Angeles.
That's right.
It's a nutty
crazy
day.
Crazy rainy day.
Almost died five times today driving to and from work. So
Well, that is a perfect mental state for you to be in for us to discuss the film we're talking about. Driving yes. through the rain and yes. angry for us to talk about Taxi Driver, yeah. 1976, Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro from a Paul Schrader script. This is one of our most requested films on Patreon.
Incredible, really.
I'm going to tell you. So Marcel Bergman, Royce Thompson, Claiborne Williams, and Rahul Parmar all, and I probably didn't pronounce all those right.
That's all right.
But they all requested this film, and we are very, very grateful for their support.
Yeah.
And Claiborne Williams is going to tell us exactly why he wanted us to review Taxi Driver.
Hey, John and Steve. This is Claiborne Williams. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I originally grew up in Northern Virginia, so shout out to Roca. The reason why I wanted you guys to talk about Taxi Driver is because it's the first film I ever saw that goes in depth into a person's psyche, their mind, their motivations. What they see is what we see throughout the entire movie. Whatever Travis Bickle feels or sees or thinks, we as the audience do as well through the entirety of Taxi Driver, which is so special and amazing to me.
And I have a feeling that if we hadn't gotten so many Patreon requests, you probably wouldn't have wanted to do it.
No.
I sense more reluctance from you on this movie than anything we've done so far.
Yeah, as soon as you said it, I was like, no, I don't. And it's because I always remember this film as a very difficult film to get through, a difficult film to watch. And it asks a lot of you to go into yeah. the psyche of a person like this. And I think I said this on the Top 10 show one time, and I said, I don't, or maybe it's our show, and I said, I don't trust someone who watches this film multiple times because it's an unsettling film.
It's deeply unsettling. Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yeah, I think it was one of those things where, like, you have to see all the Scorsese films, right? So
right.
I've spoken about many times working at Charlottesville, Virginia, having access to the UVA library of movies. This was one of them. I went through a Scorsese period where I watched Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore,
right.
like all these different early 70s or late 70s, I guess, for lack of a better time frame there.
It's in the 70s.
Yeah, it's in the 70s. There you go. The entire decade of all the Scorsese stuff, and then worked my way up to King of Comedy, and then from there you get into the popular stuff of Scorsese. But right around that time, so I went back and watched, and I remember this was very difficult to watch in a crowded library, because back then people went
too.
To libraries,
yeah.
and you sat and you watched, and you're just like, man, this is very difficult. I remember taking a couple of times, just taking a walk, to kind of shake my head out of it, because I wasn't at that like age to be able to look at it and watch it objectively. I was at that age where it could affect me in a way that was negative.
Well, I don't think it wants you to watch it objectively.
Well, that's a good point.
I think that, I mean, I struggle with this movie too, because yeah. I think like, you know, I'm very intellectual.
Sure, sure.
And I want to understand exactly why everything is in where it is. Right. And in this movie, it's just like, it just kind of has to wash over you and you experience it. It's not a movie you can sit back from.
Yeah.
For me, I watched it when I was saying exact same. This is where you're and my background is identical, which is there's this certain point where we started methodically going through films and I did the same thing. And it was, you know, sometime in college, I started watching all those Scorsese movies. I remember watching it, I think by myself on VHS, I had rented it and really, it was really hard and went, wow, I don't know how to feel about that. And I have two stories to tell of how I came to the movie. This is the first one, alone watching on VHS and getting just really, this is a really upsetting movie. And then I probably saw it once or twice after that. And then maybe 10 years ago, they were showing it in the Cinerama Dome.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to see it in the theater.
Wow.
And the experience was completely different. It was like I was watching a different movie because it was funny. And everyone was laughing.
What?
Yes. Throughout, like,
where?
Really I will talk about some of this. Like, really laughing at the film. And I went, oh, I had no idea the movie was funny. I mean, I knew Albert Brooks was funny.
Sure.
But I didn't know the movie was funny. And then when I just watched it again last night, it was kind of halfway between. There were points where I was like, this is bleak as fuck. And there were points where I was like, no, this is just actually genuine humor in a really weird way.
Yeah.
It is and maybe this is one of those movies where it's a lot of what you bring to it, you know, and where you are and who you're with. And
yeah.
Because it's a complicated film.
On so many levels. And for the record, I enjoyed the hell out of watching it this time. And I was dreading it, right? Because I was texting you. I was like, I don't know. I got to, because you were like, I'm diving into this world and it's a lot for me. And I said, yeah, I'm dreading watching it. I watched it this morning at 6 a.m. in my bed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was like, I put it to the last possible, like a procrastinating fool, to the last possible moment, I pushed it off watching it. And then eventually I opened the laptop and said, you got to tackle this thing. And I watched it and I couldn't have enjoyed this film more. Wow. And I was really surprised.
Since it was breakfast time, did you have like cereal covered with peach brandy while you were at it?
Yeah. What is that?
I don't
what
know.
What is all, the, all of it? No, but so I'm excited to talk about it.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about pre-production. So Martin Scorsese was teaching film school at UCLA when this kind of process started. And I didn't realize that Oliver Stone is one of his students. I said UCLA. Please forgive me. He's at NYU.
NYU, right.
Yeah. Sorry, NYU. I know I messed that one up. But yeah, Oliver Stone was one of his students, which I never realized.
No surprise, really.
And Paul Schrader, who's the screenwriter, who is a fascinating Hollywood character.
Yeah.
He had a religious upbringing. He didn't see a movie until his late teens.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it sounds like he went a bit crazy.
Yeah, sure.
He's a out there guy. Mm-hmm. He went, I think, into movies full on, but also into all the life I think he was denied full on because, you know, this was a very conservative upbringing. Yeah. And this guy, like 7 years after he sees his first movie, writes Taxi Driver.
Right.
Like he's been through some stuff. He goes to UCLA. He gets a degree in film. He starts writing screenplays. And there's one day that he realizes that he has not talked to another human soul for 3 weeks.
Wow.
And that is when he started writing Taxi Driver, which he wrote, I think, two drafts in about 2 weeks.
This is so interesting.
Yeah. He just and this theme of loneliness and lack of human connection that he was experiencing, that is a key to the movie. I mean, that is, you know, and I think it's something I've experienced it, maybe not to this degree, certainly not to the Travis Bickle degree.
Right.
And I think this is part of what draws us into this movie is I think every human at some point in their life has felt this isolation, this disconnect from humanity, you know?
Oh, I think when you move into a big city or when you're like ripped out of what your usual comfort zone and you have to confront the adult world and you maybe aren't prepared or ready to see the betrayals and the lies and the proclivities and the unique personality disorders of people or their tastes in sexual tastes or you drugs or any of those kinds of things, you start to see the lesser aspects of our humanity and you see it throughout the whole movie through his eyes.
Yeah.
How he views the world in disgust.
Yeah.
And we don't have any idea who this guy was before. other than what he tells Joe Spinell when he signs up right at the beginning. But we really don't know.
Not very much. We can get a few clues. But
if he's telling the truth.
If he's telling the truth.
Right.
Yeah. And the, well, it's funny, like, as you say, you can be alone in a crowded city in a way that you cannot be alone in a small town.
Yes.
Those are really different things. Mm-hmm. And so that this screenplay comes out of loneliness, and he gives it to his friend, Brian De Palma. And Brian De Palma gives it to three people. He gives it to Michael and Julia Phillips, who are producers.
Yes.
And he gives it to Martin Scorsese and says, you might be interested in this.
Wow.
Martin reads it. He wants to do it. He's like, I want to do this movie right away, instantly, because he has that same thing. He understands that loneliness, mm-hmm. that disconnection, that edge of madness that Travis Bickle has and that Paul Schrader obviously has experienced. Martin Scorsese knows that that is. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I want to do this film. But he doesn't, what he describes it, he doesn't have the juice. He's done Boxcar Bertha for Roger Corman.
Right.
And he hasn't done anything else. He hasn't done a big picture. Okay. Nobody knows who he is. And
she hasn't done Alice by this time.
No.
Okay.
So, and Michael Phillips and Julia Phillips go, we want to do this movie. And they're by the way, they're the people who developed The Sting. So mm-hmm. they're going to be really big, but not quite yet.
Yeah.
And they don't quite have the juice, and they don't have a director who has the juice, and Martin Scorsese doesn't have the juice, and a couple of years go by. And in that couple of years, Scorsese makes Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore mm-hmm. and Mean Streets, right. and they see Mean Streets, an early cut of that, and they go, oh, this is the guy. Mm-hmm. And then De Niro makes Godfather 2 and wins the Oscar, and Paul Schrader sells Yakuza to Sidney Pollack.
The Robert Mitchum one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so all of this happens in those years. And so suddenly this movie with a nobody screenwriter, a nobody director, a nobody star, all of a sudden is Academy Award winning Robert De Niro. This, and by the way, the Yakuza was sold for huge money. Uh-huh. And Martin Scorsese coming off of Mean Streets, and they go, oh, we got the juice. And De Niro's attached right from the beginning.
Right.
And I had forgotten, I think I had known it a long time ago, that De Niro knew Martin Scorsese growing up.
Yeah.
They're like friends in front of me, not close, but right. they knew who each other was yeah. and came really out of the same place.
I want to say two things. Julia Phillips, if you've never read her book, you'll never eat lunch in this town again, or you'll never work in this town again.
Oh, that's her?
That's her.
I've never read it.
And that book is phenomenal. When I used to work manage bookstores, that book, we could not keep it in stock.
Wow.
People love the Hollywood stories in there, and so sure. it's a fantastic book. The second thing, the Yakuza is an interesting thing for you to bring up, because the Japanese actor who's opposite Robert Mitchum is the
Ken
same
Tanaka.
Yeah, is the like same that. Actor in Black Rain.
Black Rain.
Yeah. yeah, and when I found that out, I was like, oh my god, it's just fantastic. So
yeah,
I think I'm right about that with Julia Phillips. But anyway,
I believe you. Yeah. I have no reason to call you a liar.
Well, I've about been this. Wrong before.
Right, exactly.
Fair. Fair.
And so they go off to start shooting it. Mm-hmm. De Niro, he's working on 1900 at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And he every time he has time off, he goes to New York and starts driving a cab.
Uh-huh.
And
to train. To kind to of train. Get, right.
And apparently, pretty good cab driver. I mean,
is it that hard? We have Uber and Lyft now. It's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, but
thing.
They have Google Maps.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And New York and the world is different. Because one of the other things we have to talk about is the world of New York that we see in Taxi Driver is completely different from the world today.
Mm-hmm. True.
And it's very much the other film that we saw this world in is French Connection.
Yes.
This dark, dirty, crime-ridden, super uber dangerous, mm-hmm. filthy in both the physical way and the sexual way place.
Well, a lot of these films in the 70s profiled that, right? Yeah. Seven Ups. A number of films did this kind of exploration stuff. It's really unsettling things, too.
Yeah. Now, the fact that they had the juice didn't mean they had a ton of money. It's mm-hmm. still a fairly small budget film. They shot it only in a couple of months, I think, less than a couple of months. Wow. And they did a lot of filming that was really just three or four or five people. Like a lot of the taxi shots is just De Niro driving the cab, Martin Scorsese and Michael Chapman, the DP, huddling in the back, and a sound guy literally in the trunk.
Wow.
Just driving around New York.
Doesn't sound dangerous at all.
Nothing bad could happen.
No rear-ending issues there.
Yeah. Let's hope not. Would you like to get into the film?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get into it.
This is among the top opening shots of any movie of all time. Steam rising up, looking like some pit of hell. and the slow motion, low angle taxi cab driving out of the steam set to Bernard Herrmann, his final score.
Man.
One of the most beautiful pieces and powerful pieces of music you can imagine.
Brother, as much as Scorsese gets credit for this movie and De Niro gets credit for this movie and Schrader for his writing, Bernard Herrmann's score is incredible. Just incredible. The movie would be nowhere near as good or as effective as this mix of dread and off-kilter happiness that
And romance.
And romance, right. Yeah. In these cues that he has throughout the whole moments. Movie.
And you know, it literally just occurred to me, which is ridiculous, but the last movie that you and I recorded together was Bernard Herrmann's first score.
Citizen Kane. Yeah.
And now,
how funny.
A week later, 2 weeks later, we are recording his last score.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. There's plenty in between.
There are, because Bernard Herrmann, you know, all the Hitchcock films and all sorts of great movies. And this score, and he passed away 2 days after recording this score.
What?
Yeah, from a massive heart attack.
I hate to break it to all you Star Wars fans. That's how John Williams is going to go out. Oh. 2 days after recording episode 9.
Doomed John Williams.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yes. And the score is just, it is powerful and dissonant and eerie and creepy and unlike anything else in film that I know of.
Right.
And then you have this. We hear the saxophone, which we're going to hear along with Travis Bickle all the time. And you have these shots of his eyes in the mirror that really pulls you into this, that this is a POV movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
That we're seeing the world through his eyes. And it is a strange world we're looking out at.
And to me, Steve, and the steam is on purpose, obviously. Everything Scorsese, he's one of these master directors that they teach you in film school. Anything that's in the frame is in the frame on purpose. Anything you see is in there. One of the things you need to learn if you're going to analyze film is all the great filmmakers follow this rule. They don't always adhere to it, but 95% of the time they do. Whatever's in the frame for a reason, either be symbolic or to evoke something from you, from your reaction, or to accentuate the plot or to push it forward. The steam right at the beginning, to me, feels like a fantasy. We're walking into a fantasy. Like you would see, you know, the old England stuff or Merlin or King Arthur. To me, when you see the steam, it's like you're walking into this world, and the way the taxi goes slowly past, and even the credits in neon are really interesting in the mood and atmosphere it creates in you when you're watching it. And then, of course, the eyes, which are brilliant. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the way Scorsese described this was that he wanted it to feel like that Travis Bickle's vision of the world was a hallucinatory documentary.
There you go. Absolutely.
Is that it is the real world.
Yeah.
But it is through this distortion of hallucination, and that the steam is a huge part of that.
Yeah.
And this is what's going to happen. Like, what's really strange about this movie that we're going to see a lot is we're almost seeing different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are times we're seeing the world from a more objective perspective, and Travis Bickle is a person in that.
Right.
And then there's times, most of the movie, we're seeing it from his perspective and how he imagines it.
Well, because that's his psyche. I think the whole movie is his. The unsettled, to all the different worlds, he's trying to find where he belongs, where he fits. And so he tries to put on these different masks, but then underneath there's this ugly truth about him that he cannot escape. No matter how much he puts on that red suit jacket, he still has to come back to that shitty one-bedroom apartment and be unable to sleep and drink all the stuff that he's drinking to just whatever he does to fill in his lives. So we see the imbalanced world because he's essentially our narrator through the movie.
Well, and even beyond going back to a shitty apartment, he is always trapped within the confines of his mind.
Yeah.
You know, that is his perception of the world.
Yeah, the cab is his mind.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Totally. Totally. So he's going to go into a job interview. That's our first sort of dialogue scene.
Yeah.
And you know, and you, the fact that you said fantasy and King Arthur, he literally walks out of the steam.
Mm-hmm.
And Scorsese said he wanted to feel like he was walking out of hell.
Yeah.
And we go into this job interview, and the camera is handled in a really weird way throughout the whole film. And you see it in the beginning in this scene. And one of the things we should say about Scorsese, maybe more than anybody else, is that he is a film scholar. Mm. Is that not only does he love films, I mean, we knew that Spielberg loves films and all sorts of directors, Quentin Tarantino loves films, but Scorsese watches films like he's encyclopedic, and he will say, oh, I got this shot from George Stevens. I got this shot from Godard. I was mimicking this thing in Shane, from Breathless, from, you know, all these different films, right, from Hitchcock. And so he talks, and there's a lot of Godard in this movie. He had the French New Wave influence, is really powerful, and the use of jump cuts and camera. You know, we talked, I think in another podcast, I don't remember which one, we talked about motivated and unmotivated camera moves.
Right.
So a motivated camera move is where someone's walking and the camera moves with them, or someone looks and the camera sees where they're looking. An unmotivated camera move is where nothing is happening and the camera just moves somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the scene, we see the camera moving in ways that are not connected to anything going on. And it's really off-putting and odd.
From the beginning, because you have three different levels, right? You have De Niro standing, you have Spinell sitting, and then you have Peter Boyle having a back and forth.
Right, the attack. In the background. So,
and we just talked about this with Citizen Kane, the deep focus, right? Like, it's to see all three things happening at the same time. Your eye is at times not sure where to go, because you don't hear the Peter Boyle dialogue that clear. And then you've got this telephone ringing the whole time with that dude sitting on the a stool waiting to answer it, you know. And the great Joseph, well, and I have to say him over and over again, because I love him in Rocky and I love him in The Godfather, is I forget the character's name, he was Cheech in The Godfather. That's the same guy. I love that we get to see some more time with Spinelli.
And it's interesting, the first question he asks is, what do you want to hack for?
Right.
And he doesn't say, because I need the money, because I like people, because I like driving. He says,
I can't sleep nights.
That's a great answer.
Some people have that affliction. One of our friends has that. He can stay up till 6 a.m. It drives him insane. I'm very happy I don't have that.
I have it.
That sounds like a torture. Do you really?
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like torture.
Not as bad as it used to be. But there are times where suddenly it's like, and you do the thing, you're lying in bed and you're going, okay, if I could fall asleep right now, I'll get 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got 2.5 hours. It's not good. Get some sleep. And you go into, sometimes you go into like a weird half sleep. Like, am I asleep? Am I asleep? Is this, no, I think I'm awake. I mean, just, it's torturous.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. It used to happen to me fairly often. And now maybe once or twice a month.
Yeah. I mean, I've had nights, maybe a total of 10 to 20 in my entire life. But I've never had like consecutive nights.
Well,
like,
and
some
I can't imagine. And we know, and Travis Bickle, it's every night.
Yeah,
that he can't sleep. And I love, he says, "Well, that's what porno theaters are for." I didn't know that's what porno theaters are for.
Maybe back in the 70s.
Maybe back in the 70s.
Right.
And he, we find out a little about him. We find out that he was in the Marines, which I do believe. I think that's definitely true.
Sure. And that wins him over.
Yeah.
Because there is that camaraderie with people who've been before in the service. You get that little bit of extra credit or consideration. Yeah. So, yeah.
And there's this one weird moment where they start talking and then the camera just kind of, it's kind of a low angle on him, and then it just booms up. It doesn't tilt up. It just goes up all of a sudden into an entirely different shot. And one of the things they're doing is that almost through the entire film, when we have shots of Robert De Niro, he's alone in the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have shots of other people, it's usually over the shoulder. So you see Robert De Niro shoulder in someone else's frame, or Robert De Niro in the background of someone else's frame. So he's always isolated and he's always in their frames. And that is exactly the opposite of standard filmmaking. Like basic filmmaking, you usually, whatever we do it even. So if I was filming this scene with you and I talking and I wanted to do a single of you and it was on a 35 millimeter lens or whatever it was, then I would turn around and use the same lens on me and the same scale and the same size so that we cut together really easily. I wouldn't shoot you in an over the shoulder and me in a single and you on one lens and me on another lens. That would be weird. And that's exactly what we see throughout Taxi Driver.
Wow.
Yeah. Just always looking different because we want him isolated from the world.
Mm-hmm. And you can break these rules when you are a master filmmaker.
Yes.
Yeah, in your mind already, you understand what the tenets of filmmaking are. But when you break the rules, you break them in a way that's interesting and artistic. Yeah.
But my students cannot do that.
Are you listening? You cannot do that.
Well, if you prove to me that you're a master filmmaker, then you're alive.
Then maybe, all right.
Yeah. And then he gets the job and
he walks
teacher, out.
You're a tough teacher, man.
Oh, yeah. It's not really that true. And the camera like moves with him for a while and then it leaves him. Yeah. It goes and looks at some other stuff and then it finds him again. Very strange things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
He walks out of the frame and walks down the street and we have these dissolved jump cuts as he moves forward, which I think he said was from George Stevens from Shane, I think.
Yeah, makes sense. Which I just watched over the weekend again.
I haven't seen it in 20 years.
That kid annoys the shit out of me. Other than that, I annoy them. I love the movie to pieces, but that kid annoys the shit out of me.
Gotcha.
But he's drinking. Like at this point, he's drinking right? It's they don't make a big deal about it in the movie, but you see him like pulling flasks out.
He's boozing, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't matter. I mean, it's not like his job requires hand-eye coordination or concentration.
To be fair, he never drinks in the cab. To be fair,
as far as we know,
as far as
he
we
does
know,
take pills in the cab.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
We're back in his apartment, and we start to hear his voiceover, and we get
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks.
Yeah, this is some dark, dark voiceover.
His voiceover is fantastic, and today I almost sent you a video of me doing some of his voiceovers. I was driving in the car just to mess with you. Yeah, but I couldn't get, like, I couldn't remember the speed because I was using my phone and I can't record my video while I'm looking at dialogue.
And driving.
but there was a turn where I was like, oh, this would be funny if I sent this to Steve before we record this.
Great. We actually
here's a man who would not sit down or whatever, or stay down, whatever. Yeah,
I watched it last night. A guest of the Cinephiles joined us, which is Dave, in addition to my wife, a guest of the Cinephiles, but Dave Rapp was with us.
How funny!
And Dave said, "I wonder if Watchmen took it from this, because the Rorschach's first lines from Watchmen are very much like Travis Bickle."
That may make sense. Absolutely makes sense.
There's a lot of Travis Bickle in Rorschach.
That's so funny. I was watching the National Championship with Dave Rapp, and I said, "I have to go home and watch Taxi Driver right after this."
Well, and he came over to our house last night.
How ironic. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah. All right. And then we're out and driving, and the shots of the cab driving are so cool.
Yeah.
Low angle shots off the mirror, off the on duty sign, and then the POV shots of just the streets of New York, which you know they weren't staged. Those are just real shots of New York.
Yeah.
They're just amazing. And his voiceover, I don't know what the darkest line in voiceover of all time is, but
all the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all the scum off the streets.
Yeah, that's some...
Yeah.
That's dark.
And you get the window into the sky, you know? And the thing is, throughout the whole movie, he's an unsettling character, but he's also has this weird kind of charm to him. There's a weird kind of charm to De Niro that you can't deny when you're watching, or else we would hate this movie. We'd hate this guy. We wouldn't want to understand him, right? But there's a kind of interesting charm to De Niro that is at times, like Sybil Shepherd says later in the film, and we'll get to it, I suppose, the contrast, the contradiction. He's walking contradiction. Yeah. And he really is, you know?
I think the people making this film, really, they all said they made it because they felt they had to make it.
Yeah.
And most of them felt like this isn't going to do well, and that probably the world is just going to reject this. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really surprised them was not only did they not reject it, but people identified with De Niro.
Yeah.
You know, with Travis Bickle. Mm-hmm. And he is in every way, you know, they describe him as a psychopath.
He is. And
And yet you're drawn into this guy. Mm-hmm. It's weird.
Because we all live in this world of black. We want to live in this world of black and white, happy, utopian, the idea of what is good and what is right. But we all know the world is actually gray, and at times a very difficult gray that we have trouble navigating, because we have to put ahead rules or laws that work for a majority of people, and it can be very difficult when those who are caught on the bad end of that, of the law, are hurt. And so, but we see these other people get away. So what he's looking is he's watching. And to me, Steve, it also struck me that this is a shark circling his prey. There was something about the way the taxi moved.
Totally.
It felt like a shark just, because a shark doesn't attack right off the bat. You know this. A shark circles around, kind of hunts, and then boom, hits the prey when it's the right
time. No, really, a shark attacks off the bat.
Really?
Yo, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're opportunity hunters. So they'll sit around on the bottom.
That's
and
what I mean.
Look up.
So that's what I mean.
Yeah. No, I guess that's true.
Yeah, they're looking for their prey. Yes. Once they find their prey, they go get it.
I think you were correct. I said it wrong.
I just want to make sure. You're the nautical expert. I'm just trying to make sure I get it right.
I don't think I'm a nautical expert.
But yeah, but that's what you said. That's like even the fin of the car felt like a shark going through the water. Point. So it was just interesting.
Well, and the thing is like he's chosen a profession that puts him in constant contact with humanity.
Right.
But not in any way that he connects with them.
Yeah.
He's always close to but disconnected from a whole bunch of life. And right now we're going to have he's going to pick up his first ride. Now, his first ride was supposed to be Martin Scorsese's mom.
Oh.
Which they shot.
Yeah.
They didn't put her in the movie.
Oh, that's a shame.
They cut her out. Instead, the first ride is this guy that they pick up that's got a girl who's like, you know, hurry up, you do your job right, you're going to get a big tip.
Yeah.
We don't exactly know what's going on with this woman. We don't know. Is she his girlfriend, his wife, his a prostitute?
Yeah.
We don't really know, but there's definitely some shenanigans going on. Mm-hmm. And we get a sense that he gets the opportunity to, or has the burden of, witnessing some weird stuff going on in the back of his cab.
Well, he does say whenever sometimes after the shift, I have to clean the cum and the blood, and sometimes the blood off the back of the car. And you're just like, man, that's terrible existence.
Yeah,
you're really nasty. You're cleaning up after people.
By the way, that guy in the suit in the back seat is the writer of the book Raging Bull. That's who that is.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
And so after he drops off his cab and has to, as you say, clean it up from various bodily fluids, he goes off to a beautiful movie theater called The Show and Tell.
Yes.
And walks in and starts talking to the woman behind the counter there, wants to know her name.
Can I help you?
Yeah, what's your name? My name is Travis.
That's nice. What can I do for you?
Well, I can know what your name is. What's your name?
Give me a break.
Well, you can tell me what your name is. I'm not going to do anything, you know.
Do you want me to call a manager?
Oh, you don't have to call the manager. I mean, I'm just asking.
Troy!
Who is Diane Abbott?
Diane Abbott, really?
Who plays his love interest in King Comedy.
Oh,
yeah, that's Diane Abbott. So, yeah.
It is an uncomfortable scene.
Very uncomfortable. And especially in light of 2018, Steve.
Yep.
When we have women talking about how they're constantly hit on, they're just trying to do their job. Men are always trying to hit on them in inopportune ways.
Well, in particular, when you're the working the counter at a porn movie theater.
It kind of goes with the job. I hate to break it to you.
The kind of guys that are walking in. I mean, just walking in like, hey, what's your name? And then she won't tell him the name. And then he's like, come on, I'm not going to do anything. These are not the things to say.
Right.
And
right.
It's very clear, by the way, this is the 9 millionth time that she's been through this. And she is just like calling the manager and he backs down.
She just says Troy so quickly.
Yeah.
I love the, it feels so natural, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love they have chuckles too. I didn't know that.
Chuckles. And he gets, a Clark bar.
Clark bar.
Goobers, popcorn, cola, RC cola for $1.85.
Well, that tells you the product placement that they were only able to get was not the high-end shit.
I don't think this is product placement.
You don't think, what?
I think this is just the stuff they used.
There's no way they would have allowed them to use that kind of stuff. Even, you know, RC Cola.
The rules were different.
Really?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
If this is something, because this came up once before in another movie. I don't remember which one.
All right.
And I said the same thing, but I actually have not researched. So I probably should find that
out. We should find that. Yeah. But it sounds like, because it's all lower end.
Yeah,
on the candy space. Even the Clark bar is not necessarily the number one candy bar you go for. So I'm just
somebody
saying.
Does.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure there's a Clark bar fan page out on the internet somewhere.
Sure, sure.
He goes into the theater, and this was shot in a real porn theater. There was real porn on the screen, and what they had to do is they had to take it out with an optical.
Yeah, you can tell.
So that we're not actually seeing it. He has this line that we're saying.
12 hours of work, and I still can't sleep. Damn. Days go on and on. They don't end.
Man, driving a cab all night and then in the morning going into an all 24-hour porn theater and you can't sleep, that's rough.
Yeah, I used to work an overnight shift at a television station programming, master programming commercials.
Yeah.
It was a struggle to stay awake from 6 to 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
So I would go in at 10 or 11, do the news, and then program the rest of the night. And it and that's when I watched all those movies that my friend gave me, mini film school that I was in. And then by 6 o'clock, though, it was everything to keep me awake until 8. Then I got home and fell asleep. So to me, I can't imagine 12 hours and then still not being able to sleep. That would drive me insane.
In a porn theater with dudes jerking off next to you. Yes. Like, that is not...
Talk about cleaning the cum off the seats.
Jesus. Oh, my God.
Hey-o.
Okay. By the way, maybe we should have put the warning at the beginning of the podcast that we're going to get into some stuff.
It's Taxi Driver, friends. Yeah.
He goes back home, and there's this line that I love, which is...
All my life needed was a sense of someplace to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
Yeah.
Now, a person like other people, I think about that a lot, because I've always thought about this, is that I think we see, when we look inside ourselves, we see ourselves as filled with holes and inconsistencies, and we're insecure and we're unsure and we don't quite know what we're doing all the time. And when we look outside at other people, they all seem solid.
Yeah.
Like they know what they're doing. Like they've got this figured out on some level. And of course, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. But a person like other people, no, you are like other people.
Yeah.
This is how we all are, you know?
Yeah. But it's also his observant nature, right? What he thinks he sees. But, you know, that's an interesting, because I think those of us who are more sensitive or artists or whatever you want to call, whatever term, I'm not trying to be cocky, arrogant or anything like that, but whatever term you want to call us, we see the world differently than like Joe Schmo half the time, because he's just trying to get through his life. And so it's our job, as the way we're built, to observe other people and be like, oh, I want to be like that. I want to catch like that.
I agree.
Where I think other people observe and they want to go, I want to get that level. I don't think I'm necessarily go, oh, I just want to be a human.
I would say it slightly differently, because there's a difference between, I would say it's definitely true that some people are observers and some people really aren't.
Yeah.
You know, but what I would say is different. Like, what surprised me is Harry Potter comes out. This is a strange analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And becomes the most popular book in the history of the world.
Sure.
And Harry Potter is the conflicted, worried about, you know, the perceptions of him,
right.
Insecure. I relate as a nerdy kid. Mm-hmm. I like go, Harry Potter is like me. I relate to him.
Right.
Why does it become the most successful book of all time? And I think the answer is that even that normal Joe guy, even the captain of the football team and the prom queen and the, you know, businessman and the rich guy and all those people, they actually all feel like Harry Potter. Some of the time.
Yeah.
Like even though from the outside, they don't now, but that being said, they don't become observers like you and I became necessarily,
right.
But they still feel that way.
Mm-hmm. But I think him doing that, like, I want to be people like other people.
Yeah.
That just tells you right there. This is a man trying to find his place.
Absolutely.
In the world.
Well, and this points out, I mean, this is a film about loneliness, among other things. And like this idea is what points out what I would call like the paradox of loneliness.
Yeah.
Which is that, basically, everybody feels lonely.
Mm-hmm.
I've never talked to anybody and had that kind of conversation who doesn't feel lonely, not just some of the time, but a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Even people with big families and relationships in big cities with big groups of friends like we have.
Right.
And the great paradox is that, well, we all are feeling the same way and we're all next to each other. And yet bridging the gap and solving our own loneliness is almost an impossible thing to do some of the time.
Well, I think sometimes if you speak it, you almost speak it into existence, and it's almost too much to handle.
Yeah.
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 And everyone's lonely in different ways as well. So that's the thing.
Well, because there's Paul Schrader, who realized he hadn't spoken to a human for 3 weeks.
Right.
And there might be people who speak to humans every single day.
Yep.
They're constantly surrounded by family and all these people, and they're still lonely.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm. I know nothing about that.
Yeah, me neither.
Go next.
Let's meet Betsy.
Hello.
He says the first time he saw her at Ballantyne headquarters, she was wearing a white dress.
Mm.
Did you think of Citizen Kane and Bernstein?
Oh, no.
That line comes out, she was wearing a white dress.
How interesting,
my brain immediately goes to Bernstein.
Damn, that works so well.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if
they're from Citizen Kane, for those who are
from Citizen Kane. Yeah. Go back and listen to our month of Kane to find out what we're talking about.
Thank God we're not doing the month of Taxi Driver.
Oh, Jesus. I can handle it.
We wouldn't survive. Yep.
And by the way, when we watch her going in, and the shot is beautiful, mm-hmm. the first shots of Sybil Shepherd going into these campaign headquarters, Martin Scorsese sitting on the stoop yep. outside the door.
Yeah, I caught him this time.
I didn't see it. Dave Rapp saw it. I yep. didn't notice him.
Yep.
And we go in and we're hearing him talk, and there's this beautiful dissolve from her to him writing about her, mm-hmm. and that is from Jean-Luc Godard.
Oh, okay.
It's a lift from Godard.
They cannot touch her.
Her.
Oof.
Yeah. And what has he done? Does he know anything about this real person?
No, he has, you know, put her on a pedestal. He's like created this whole world of her that is all in his mind. Once again, yeah. she's the angel in this wasteland of people, you know, and he thinks like if he can get with her, he might save himself or, yeah. You know, be above them even more. I don't know. But he totally like fantasizes what she is.
And I, of course, have never done that.
Right.
We go into the campaign.
None of us have ever done that.
We go into the campaign headquarters and there we meet Sybil Shepherd, who mm-hmm. we saw walk in, and Albert Brooks.
Albert Brooks.
Albert Brooks is so damn funny.
Mm-hmm. He's an American treasure, man.
He is. One of the movies I absolutely want to do is Lost in America.
Okay.
So much.
It'll be one of those where I watch for the first time. I've never seen that movie.
I know you haven't. It is so damn funny.
Well, then I will throw broadcast news out there. We eventually have to tackle that.
Sure. Yeah, I love that movie. I haven't seen it since the 80s.
God. I own it. It's Criterion. I have it. I watch
I really
it all
liked
the time.
It. I it's just great. Haven't gone back to it that much. All right. Yeah. So we have a date. And maybe we should do those back to back. We'll do maybe. Broadcast Brews and Lost in America.
Maybe we should get Albert to come on.
Oh, I would love it. Do you know? So I remember here. So I heard it was on Mark Maron's podcast.
Oh, great.
He had Carl Reiner on. Yeah. He's had Rob Reiner on.
Reiner's great.
He's had Mel Brooks on. So Albert Brooks grew up right like next door to the Reiners.
Oh, yeah.
And Albert Brooks was Rob Reiner. They were like best friends. Mm-hmm. And so Albert Brooks would come over and hang out. And Carl Reiner's best friend, of course, is Mel Brooks. And right. so Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft are hanging out with Carl Reiner. And over would come Rob Reiner and his best friend, Albert Brooks. And all three of those people, Rob Reiner, Carl Reiner, and Mel Brooks, all said that 12-year-old Albert Brooks is the funniest human they had ever seen in their entire lives. And that, to me, is like Mel Brooks wow. and Carl Reiner
yeah.
saying, this kid is the funniest person anyone has ever seen.
It's incredible.
And he was this bizarre stand-up comic at this time in the mid-70s mm-hmm. and doing the Saturday Night, I think he was doing the Saturday mm-hmm. Night Live movies at this time. And for Scorsese to cast him in this movie is so odd. And he is like in a different film.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God, because
yeah.
you need some lightness.
He's yeah.
so funny. He's doing this monologue about talking on the phone about campaign buttons or something, all of which is improv that he made up. And Paul Schrader thanked him. He said, you know what? That's the one character in the movie I didn't know.
No.
And you created something great. And thank awesome. You so much for improving all that stuff.
Yeah, sometimes actors matter. Sometimes people.
They do. Yeah. I thought of 18 horrible things to say and I yeah. just decided to move on. They do matter, absolutely. Because they're working for this senator and Sybil mm-hmm. Shepherd seems to be maybe Albert Brooks's boss.
I think they're equal? Both equals, but they're managers of different departments.
Maybe.
That's what I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Now look, we have to emphasize the mandatory welfare program. That's the issue that should be pushed.
First push the man, then the issue. Senator Palentine is a dynamic man, an intelligent, interesting, fresh, fascinating
forgot sexy.
Man. I did not forget sexy.
Do you get the sense that Sybil Shepherd kind of likes the Senator Palentine?
Yes. I think when he calls her out for not saying sexy,
yeah,
it's a clear indication.
Yeah, I think so, too. There's all sorts of little bits where like where she says, look out and see that cab driver.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, okay, I'm looking. She says, put your glasses on. He said, okay, I'll put them on. And he's already got them on. It's just really, Albert Brooks is one of those people where I don't know why that's funny.
Yeah.
But he is just funny.
But she knew that he had them on. So they have this little, they're just having a little banter, which they probably do to just yeah. get through the day, have these moments that, you know, you always find that one person in the office that understands your humor and you can just have these moments between each other.
Do you like, are you a Sybil Shepherd fan?
I'm a Sybil Shepherd fan as an actress. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah, I hear too many terrible stories about her behind the scenes, so I'm not the biggest fan of that. But in this film, she is beautiful. Absolutely
is.
Beautiful and very natural. And that's what you look for. Like she was in Last Picture Show. Very natural.
I think in those two movies, see, I am not the biggest fan.
I love Moonlighting. I love Moonlighting,
but I don't think she's the greatest actress.
Right.
But in Last Picture Show and in this, I think she is sparkling mm-hmm. and natural and relaxed yeah. and really good.
Yeah.
You know?
She's having a great inner monologue too, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
That I really enjoy.
There's a lot. There's definitely a lot going on. And what's going on right now is she's looking out the window and there's this cab driver staring at her. So Albert Brooks goes, you want me to get rid of him? And he goes outside. And as soon as he starts talking to De Niro hits the gas and drives away. I love, by the way, that Albert Brooks says, I'll be the male in the relationship. And she says, good luck.
And I don't need good luck. Thank you.
Oh, yes, you do. You just think you don't.
And it's funny. This is 1970, what, six? Already playing on this idea of gender stereotypes, right?
Yeah.
The great comedians have always found the joke of the gender stereotype. And we're just now getting around to it as in mass as a society. But it's always been there. And I think this scene is important too, Steve, because she doesn't encourage him to get rid of Travis.
No.
So there's a little bit of the good girl that likes the bad boy here. And I don't think it is a negative way. It's just the excitement of it, right? Because this is, seems like the kind of person who's kind of had everything kind of laid out for her and she's done what she's done and she's strived to achieve the greatest. And then you have this kind of guy come in who's a little different. So
a little different.
Well,
well, we don't know that yet.
Fair, Steve. Fair, yes. Fair.
He's going to be pretty different. He goes off. There's more driving. And again, the, he have these beautiful POV shots. And one of the things he seems to be looking at now is romantic things.
Yeah.
So he's out looking at romantic things. And by the way, when De Niro's driving the cab for research, it's he's even driving it after he had just won the Oscar for Godfather 2.
Oh, my God.
So a guy gets in the cab who's an actor.
Yeah.
And is looking up at the, because he has his his hack license up on the, you know, the wall. And he goes, I thought it was, because it says Robert De Niro. And he says, are things really that hard?
Do you need some help, brother? Do
you
need some
you just won the Oscar. Isn't that great?
Can't you melt that thing down?
Let's have dinner with the other drivers. What's fascinating about this scene is the incredible disconnection of Travis Bickle.
Yeah.
He doesn't respond quickly. He's always looking at something else. He's always, and what's weird, and this is what I mean by like the, we're within his world, and then we're also within the world of other people with him in it. Because, and I don't know, I'm sure you have been around the crazy person.
Yes.
Where you're like, what's going on in there?
Well, I hate to break it to you, but everybody in this scene is not normal. And so, and I've been in this room with not normal people in numerous jobs or walks of my life. So this is a scene that I know very well. Now, there are times that I've sat by myself on purpose because these people are a little too weird.
A little too much.
But he is doing it because like he's trying to find his place. So he is not going to walk into a situation and ingratiate himself with people right off the bat.
No. Well, and I don't know what he...
And Doughboy is not someone you want to get to know and be friends with. You know?
Yeah, there's it's a strange group. I mean, Peter Boyle, the great Peter Boyle.
The great Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
The late, great Peter Boyle.
Tells a very off-color story about a sexual exploit in the back of a cab that you can have feelings about.
And then he's surprisingly advanced about homosexual rights.
I know.
He's surprisingly
this
advanced.
Thing about, well, in California, they have to play alimony.
They really
they're
got
way ahead of us.
They're way ahead of us.
Which is true.
Yeah, right, right. By the way, the actor who plays Doughboy is the father of Bimmel, of the girl in Silence of the Lambs. When Jodie Foster goes to look through the house, he's the father. He's the actor who plays the father. Yep.
Wow. Okay. And when they start try to engage Travis Bickle in conversation, he doesn't quite respond.
Yeah.
Travis. Travis. You run all over town, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you handle some pretty rough customers, huh?
Yeah.
You carry a piece?
No.
You need one?
No.
If you ever need one, I know a fella can get you a real nice deal. Lots of shit around.
He puts some Alka-Seltzer in a cup, and then we just kind of zoom in on the cup for a while. And see that, again, that's also a reference to Godard.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of Godard in here.
Okay.
But the thing that Scorsese said about how he wanted to film the movie was he wanted to film the movie the way he sees the world.
Mm.
And
Travis or Scorsese?
Scorsese.
Interesting.
Okay. And what he says is, and I get this, is there times, I'm sure you've done this too, where you're in a place and you just suddenly start looking at a thing and your whole consciousness goes to that thing. Isn't that interesting? Maybe some person that's walking by. Maybe it's some, and you just spend a little time, and maybe it only took a second in real time, but or a half a second or a split second. But in your mind, you spend a little while in there, and that's what happens when you just go into that Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where his brain is. And then we're back with the drivers, and they don't know that any weird thing happened. You know, they might know that the person they're talking with is operating at a different speed,
right?
But they don't know where they are.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a weird scene. Mm-hmm. Doughboy wants to sell him a piece of Errol Flynn's bathtub.
That's so strange.
It's really strange. In the back, by the way, there's a political poster, and the poster is of the opposition to Palantine.
Oh, okay.
And that is the AD of the film. Who's on that picture?
Great.
We go back to campaign headquarters. There's this weird thing about how would you light a match with missing a bunch of fingers?
Yeah, right.
That's all invented by them.
Of course.
Yeah. And by the way, so they're doing it, and you have Albert Brooks with a match in his mouth, and he's trying to drag the little sandpaper thing across his face. I was like going, man, I hope he doesn't light it, because he's going to like have a lit flame right under his nose. It's painful.
I hate to break you, I'm sure he wasn't trying to light it, because he was so obviously off. You know, he light his face off.
Albert Brooks is not a method actor?
That's right.
De Niro would have been trying to light it.
Of course he would have been, yeah.
And he would have lit that.
He would have practiced it for weeks.
He would have. In comes Travis.
Yeah.
The camera moves when he enters. Mm-hmm. There's like a dolling back, zooming back thing with him. And then we switch to his POV that drives in on Cybill Shepherd in a very aggressive and kind of creepy way. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing about this. This is, by the way, going to be him at his most charming, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And there's still that thing about him that's like,
a
little weird.
Well, there's a boldness to him, too, that has to be almost respected, because he doesn't walk in sheepishly. He walks in straight ahead. He knows, and he goes, I'm going to volunteer. I don't want to volunteer with you. Yeah. I want to volunteer with her. And Cybill, or the character, plays it in a way that she's interested in this guy. She has interest in him because she knows it's the tax driver that's been watching her. And so there is a little adventure here to take with him.
And as you said earlier, something about her interested in bad guys.
Absolutely. Little danger. Yeah.
Well, and the thing, and we know, I think we can be pretty sure that Travis Bickle rehearsed these lines in his head.
Oh, sure.
A long time. Mm-hmm. He knew this was weeks in the making.
Well, what else are you going to do if you're awake all day, all night?
Fair point. Yeah. He's sitting in that porn room saying, what am I going to say to that girl in the white dress? And he is really pretty persuasive.
Would you like to come have some coffee and pie with me?
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. I think you're a lonely person. I drive by this place a lot. I see you here. I see a lot of people around you. And I see all these phones and all this stuff on your desk. And it means nothing. And then when I came inside and I met you, I saw in your eyes and I saw the way you carried yourself that you're not a happy person. And I think you need something. And if you want to call it a friend, you can call it a friend.
You're going to be my friend?
Yeah.
It is bold.
Some people respond to boldness, man. And also, he does the classic primal male thing. Now, you see this in Species, you see this in animals, you see this in men as well. He denigrates the male that is the closest to her. He systematically denigrates him and insults him and kind of undercuts him, so he is not seen as a viable suitor for her. It's classic shit.
Well, and as fascinating as watching De Niro and Cybill Shepherd in this scene, you also should just rewind the scene and watch Albert Brooks. Yes. Because he is peeking out from behind the wall and up from under the desk, and he's over on the side.
Of course.
It is so funny.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask an obvious question here. How does Albert Brooks feel about Cybill Shepherd, about Betsy?
Well, I think he has that thing that he has in Broadcast News as well, this like nerdy love for the beautiful girl that he's never going to get, not in the 80s and the 70s, certainly in the 2000s and the 2010s, nerdy guys get all the beautiful girls now. But like back then, it really was about observing and hoping if I could wear her down or catch her at the right time, maybe she'd go out with me. So you become that friend first for a while, and then you make that switch, because that's what people tell me all the time, that sometimes you can be friends with someone for 20 years and all of a sudden it clicks and you have this romantic. I've never had that experience, but I know a lot of people that do. So maybe he's just that. People play the long game all the time.
Yeah.
But I think he also respects her as a person.
There's no question that
absolutely.
He does.
It isn't just the physical attraction. She's very intelligent, very command of her space, and that's attractive.
Well, and I think they obviously have a lovely relationship.
Yes, very much
they have a great relationship.
Yeah.
And there's one moment I want to go back to. There's this strange moment that happens where he says, I see you here and I see a lot of people around you. And then he does this gesture and we go into this top-down shot of the desk, mm-hmm. which is very strange. Last top-down we shot, we saw, was when he hands in his paperwork mm-hmm. when he's in the job interview. And we're going to see top-down shots. And they come in this very noticeable way.
Yes.
And then they go out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what they mean exactly, but I'm going to point them out as we go along mm-hmm. because there's something very interesting about the choice to do that. Mm-hmm. And then he says, you know, I want to take you out maybe to pie and coffee. And she agrees.
Eventually, yeah. She says, well, if I get up, I get off at 4 o'clock and if you're here. And he's like, oh, I'll be here.
Yeah.
And she's like, I have no doubt you will be.
And after four, we go mm-hmm. out to a diner. Mm-hmm. He narrates what they have, which is he had apple pie with cheddar cheese, which is, I forget what regions that comes from. It's a very, have you ever had it?
No, thanks.
It's interesting.
And don't confuse my mouth, man.
Look, sometimes a little savory, a little sweet, a little buttery, a little fruity.
Yeah, it's not my jam.
But no, it's. I would rather have some ice cream or some whipped cream, but yeah. I respect the, you know... Whatever. Oh, you know what I should have found out?
What's that?
That's going to tell us where Travis Bickle's from.
Oh, good point.
I think it's Midwestern.
Oh.
But I'm not sure. I should have researched that. Okay. That's a good point.
Fair.
And they're shooting this. This is in Columbus Circle where they're shooting. And that just shows how the world has changed. There is no cheap diner like that in Columbus Circle.
Anymore?
Columbus Circle is billion-dollar property values.
Now. Yeah.
Now. Okay. The world has changed.
Yeah.
They start chatting. They make a little joke about getting organized. And Cybill Shepherd makes a joke. He doesn't quite get it. And then he goes after, just as you say, he goes after Albert Brooks' character. Mm-hmm. I don't like that guy you work with.
You like the guy you work with?
He's okay.
Yeah, but I know. But do you like him?
Well, he's funny and he's very good at his job. He's okay. Though he does have a few problems.
I would say he has quite a few problems. When I walked in and I saw you two sitting there, I could just tell by the way you were both relating that there was no connection whatsoever. And I felt when I walked in that there was something between us. There was an impulse that we were both following. So that gave me the right to come in and talk to you.
Yeah.
Wow. That is some stuff.
And then she says he's right. I wouldn't be here if I didn't.
Yep.
But what's interesting throughout the scene too, Steve, is that he knows he's punching above his weight. And the two or three times.
About eight levels.
Yeah, right. And the two or three times, which is master acting. If you're an actor or if you're a person who appreciates acting, watch De Niro in this scene. There are two or three moments where she says something and De Niro betrays this feeling of angry uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
This feeling, you're making me feel stupid,
yeah.
right? Because he's not composed enough to understand that that's not necessarily what she's doing. She's just talking because she's educated and she's just talking regular.
Well, she's not trying to make
No, she's not. That's what I'm saying. She's not trying to, but he feels a little bit of that. And it starts to erode this angelic view he has of her.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and the thing too, and we see this before, we saw it in the very beginning when the interviewer guy said, you want a moonlight? And he says, I just want to work all
yeah,
the
what does
time.
That mean? What is moonlight?
I don't know what moonlight means.
Yeah.
Travis Bickle is not the most educated of guys.
No.
He's not out there paying attention to the world.
Right.
And she compares him to the song from Kris Kristofferson.
Mm-hmm. Who's that?
The songwriter. He's a prophet. He's a prophet and a pusher. Partly truth, partly fiction. Walking contradiction.
You saying that about me?
Well, who else would I be talking about?
I'm no pusher. I never have pushed.
No, just the part about the contradictions. You are that.
I don't know what that song is, do you?
No, I don't know the song, no. Yeah. But, I mean, it makes sense for Kris Kristofferson during the 70s to sing songs like that. But like,
well, and it certainly makes sense about Travis Bickle.
Mm-hmm. Which he finds offense in.
Yeah, he does. He's like, what are you trying to say about me? And he says, maybe they're going to go to a movie and... You know what? This is a pretty good first date.
Yeah.
Do you think, because we've both seen it a few times.
Yeah.
How does the audience feel? How do we feel about this first date?
Who hasn't been? Well, the date seems actually sweet, even with the flashes of anger, I think, or frustration that he feels stupid in certain moments compared to her. The date still feels sweet. So we have this other level of Travis that we haven't seen before. You know, and like a demon, he's wearing red. Yeah. So there is this feeling that he is still off center. And she even calls him on it, saying he's a walking contradiction. But it's still a sweet scene. It's but then we start to maybe dread the situation because we've seen this other side of
Travis. That's what I was going to say. It's like, I think it is a sweet scene, but I think it just leaves you in a sense of dread because you know this is not real. This cannot work. This cannot work out. This is, and whatever he was able to summon in himself to become the person he becomes, who walks into that campaign office and then has this snack with her at the diner, that is not him.
No.
And that he's not going to maintain that.
Well, that's him trying to be a real person, right? Like Pinocchio trying to be a boy.
Yeah. I was reading about, there's a guy who is a very well-known journalist who whose son has two sons who are schizophrenic, and the eldest one committed suicide. Ooh. And they thought he was doing pretty well when, in fact, he really wasn't doing well.
Wow.
And now they have this younger son, and they're just terrified, of course, because he's also schizophrenic. And what he talked about was that someone who has mental problems has learned how to work really hard in order for people to not know that this is what they're going through.
Sure.
To appear, oh, this is how I'm supposed to behave in these circumstances. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what's going on in my head all the time, I'm going to like just do what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And that's Travis very much in this scene. He has worked really hard to present a certain thing. And that's what, so what, one of the things that's interesting about this film is that this film seems so ahead of its time and so timely right now, because we didn't have the term PTSD when this film came out. I mean, we certainly knew that that veterans coming back from war, and this is a Vietnam veteran who had been a Marine coming back, you know, that they deal with problems, but we didn't really understand them as well as we do today, and hopefully we'll understand them much better in the future. And then also, like, we live in the world, and this is something we'll get into, is of mass shootings. And those ideas and what happens to someone as they go down these pathways of mental illness and desire for violence and how they're seeing the world. Travis Bickle, man.
Yeah. And now I remember what I was going to say, because it ties into what you just said, Steve. I don't feel dread just for Sybil Shepherd. This time around, I felt dread for him.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, in the past, I've seen him as just this guy who's going to lose it and do what he does at the end of the movie. But this time around, I found more compassion, for lack of a better term, to try to understand him and try to stop him.
I definitely feel that.
Right? And we see that later on when he has that conversation with Peter Boyle by the taxi cab outside. He's desperate to stop this happening to himself, but he can't stop it. He doesn't have the tools to stop it. I think PTSD is a way to, is a great connection to make about him, that he may be going through this. Well, and how many people went through it and couldn't explain it to themselves in the 70s?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, how do you? How do you deal with... And what's interesting, too, about him is on a fundamental level, he wants to be a hero.
Yes. Yes. Now, as warped of a hero as he can be, but he does.
But he frames the world as good guys and bad guys and sees himself as one of the good guys.
He does.
Absolutely.
Right.
As messed up as that is.
Well, every villain thinks they're doing the right thing.
But not every villain goes and buys a Kris Kristofferson album, which is what he does
he
next.
He does, yes.
And he calls Betsy. They agree they're going to go to a movie. Yeah. And the only thing he forgot to ask was her last name, but things are going pretty well. And then what happens next? He's driving his cab, and who should get into his cab but Betsy's boss, Senator Palentine, who he recognizes, and he just brightens up. He says, I'm one of your biggest supporters.
Yeah.
I tell everybody they have to vote for you.
Why, thank you. Travis?
This scene is so funny. Well, this is where you ask, why is this movie funny? This scene is funny.
Yes, but
I mean, it's weird.
It's also uncomfortable.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, right?
It is very, because what's funny is you could see Travis putting on this certain kind of thing, because he doesn't know anything about the senator.
No.
Not at all.
Not at all.
He's just in love with Betsy.
Right.
And then the senator asks him, well, what would you change if you could change anything? Oh, I'm not really into politics.
Political issues.
He says, oh, and I love too that the senator says,
let me tell you something. I have learned more about America from riding in taxi cabs than in all the limos in the country.
Such a political. And then he says, he, you know, pushes him to say, what would you change? And he says, oh, well, I clean up this city here. It's like an open sewer filled with filth and scum.
I know. Just revealing his inner monologue.
Yeah. And it just starts to rise up.
Whatever becomes the president should just really clean it up. You know what I mean? Sometimes I go out and I smell it. I get headaches. It's so bad, you know? And they just never go away, you know? It's like
think that the president should just clean up this whole mess here. He should just flush it right down the fucking toilet.
And you can see the senator, again, being political. He takes it in.
Yeah.
And then he's like, what? And you see the guy he's with going, what the fuck is going on here? And then he, I love the turn. He goes,
well, I think I know what you mean, Travis. But it's not going to be easy. We're going to have to make some radical changes.
Damn straight.
And he does what politicians do. He spins it, you know?
Yep, exactly. But wait, do you find his name interesting, Palantine?
Yeah, it's a Roman, what is it? It's a...
Yeah, was it emperor? No. I'm thinking Palantine.
There's the Palatine Hill in Rome.
Right.
And I think there's also a figure, but I can't tell you exactly what it is.
In my mind, I was thinking palindrome.
Mm.
Is there a way that palindrome works for him? Like, same backwards?
Same way backwards and forwards?
Yeah.
I am sure that a smart guy like you could figure out a way that that
I'm
works.
I'm trying to figure out mentally as I think about it now as we do this podcast. Anyway, it's interesting.
Again, but as you said, nothing is here by accident.
Yeah.
You know, Paul Schrader and Martin Scorsese, they picked those names. Mm-hmm. He shakes hands with the senator, goes away, and he's driving along and stops, and who gets into his cab but Jodie Foster?
Right. Or tries to.
Tries to, yeah.
Come on, man. Get me out of here, all right? Come on!
So we should say that Jodie Foster was 12 years old when she made this movie.
Wait, what? Legitimately 12 years old?
Oh, yeah.
What?
She was 12 years, 7 months old.
So what he says about her in the film is true? What Sports says? She's 12 and a half years old?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Holy shit. This is an incredibly composed 12-year-old.
First of all, she's amazing.
Yes.
And I remember, so I don't know if you watched it, but I grew up watching Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I saw Jodie Foster first, because she's his best friend.
Yeah.
And then she's in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Right.
So he had worked with her before, and he went to the mom and said, I want her to do this script. She'd be perfect. And the mom said, okay.
Was she in Bad News Bears? No.
No, that's Tatum O'Neill.
She was in Little Foxes.
I think so, yes.
That's where I saw her first. And then, and Bugsy Malone.
On Bugsy Malone, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bugsy Malone.
By the way, I 100% want to do Bad News Bears.
Okay, yeah, definitely.
I love that movie.
I thought you were going to say Bugsy Malone.
No. You're going to have to Patreon a lot of money for us to do Bugsy Malone with Scott Baio.
Scott Baio and Jodie Foster, and they are like 15 years old, or maybe even 12, I guess, 12,
kid
13.
Gangsters.
They're kid gangsters. It's a really funny, sweet 70s film.
I watched take on a gangster. When I was a kid, I haven't watched it in 30 years, and I don't think I'm going to.
Did they shoot machine guns, but they're cream pies?
But they're cream pies. You've watched it a lot.
It's one of my favorites.
But we digress.
Yes.
Jodie Foster.
How did Bugsy Malone sneak in here? Yeah.
She gets into the cab.
Yeah.
And is saying, go, take me away. And he's moving kind of slow and looking in the mirror.
He's an observer. He's an observer.
And in comes a hand and someone drags her out of the cab.
Yeah.
And it is upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy is a recognizable outfit, although we don't see who it is.
We don't see his face, which I think is brilliant. No.
But you see that he's wearing sort of a cowboyish sort of
The wife beater shirt, yeah.
And he throws a very crumpled $20 bill onto the front seat and says, you know, drive on. And Travis Bickle drives on.
Yeah. But then we, as the observer, or unless he's looking through his rearview mirror, we see her keep trying to pull away from Harvey Keitel, which is Sport, and two or three times before we finally move away from them.
This is a key moment in the film. I think this is the failure of his heroic knight in shining armor image of himself that he's going to spend the rest of the movie trying to recover from.
Oh, interesting. I never thought that.
Not saving her.
Oh.
She needed saving and he didn't save her.
How funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it certainly haunts him because he doesn't spend that $20 until later on.
And this is good filmmaking. Yeah. That is very specifically crumpled.
Yes.
So that when we see it again and again, we recognize where it's from.
Yep.
You know, it's a very small thing, but it's really important.
Yeah.
And then he goes on another one of these drives. He gets egged by kids and stuff thrown at his cab. And I love their shots of the open fire hydrants and water streaming out. And he goes through the water because it's a hot, hot summer.
Right.
And it is just this image of this New York at this era. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
It's quite a snapshot.
Yeah. And he finally gets back to the base, the operations where the taxis are. Mm-hmm. And that $20 bill is still sitting on the front seat. and the camera goes up to his face, and it goes down to the $20 bill as he grabs it, and back up to his face. And I know this sounds silly, but those are hard shots.
Okay.
Just technically, because you got to pull focus, and he moves pretty fast, and that camera's got to, you got to be, it's like a dance. The camera operator, the focus puller, and the actor all have to be in perfect, perfect sync to get that shot correct.
Wow.
It's, I mean, it's little. It's not like doing like the huge tracking Steadicam shot going into the Copacabana in Goodfellas. It's not right. like that. Mm-hmm. But it still takes real professionals really, really working well together.
Yeah.
In fact, Martin Scorsese said that was a really tough shot to get.
Okay.
It's time for the date.
Yeah.
I think this date's going to go really well. How about you?
No.
He's walking through this long, super long lens shot, so everything's out of focus except him. He's back in that corduroyish, rust-colored jacket.
Yeah, that's all he has.
It looks good. Got a tie now.
Mm-hmm.
Sybil looks beautiful.
Yes.
In this white kind of knit dress. She had some expensive costumes, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He gives her the record. We see this drummer who's got like shoe polish in his
hair. Yeah.
Apparently, Peter Boyle found that drummer and said, Marty, you got to hear this guy. And they put him in the movie. That's He's a perfect. Real street player.
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
That's the New York ambiance.
And we're going to see a great movie. It's 1975. Maybe we'll go see Rocky or
sure.
a lot of good films came out that year.
Sure.
Or maybe we'll go see Sometime Sweet Susan. It seems like a higher class theater than the Pay and Play or whatever the place
yeah.
you went to.
Yeah.
Before.
It's because it's a foreign porn. Yeah. It's foreign porn. Yeah.
Swedish.
Yes.
And her reaction is like,
you gotta be kidding.
What?
This is a dirty movie.
No, this is a movie that a lot of couples come to. All kinds of couples go here.
Sure about that?
Yeah, I see them all the time.
But she's excited.
That was my question.
Yes.
She still decides to go in.
Yes.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Let's have this conversation. Because first of all, so she goes
in. This is what The Cinephiles is about, my friend.
Yes. She goes in. She sees the movie. She starts to hide herself and then gets upset, leaves. He tries to stop her from, then he gets physical with her by grabbing her arm two or three times, which I guess at the time, maybe it wasn't considered that physical, but now, of course,
now it's much worse.
Very much so, it is. And she is disgusted with him.
Yeah.
And we've all been on that date where...
I've never been on this date.
No, I'm not saying that. Where we take our girl to a porn movie. No, we've been on that date where...
As you do.
Where you're right, where the attraction dissipates because maybe a comment was said or a reaction was had. And then, like, either they or you, and then the attraction, the date is over. And you're not going to see this person again because you're just like, nope.
Even I, who have very little dating experience,
yes,
was on that date.
There you go. So when it happens, though, but this is so interesting. I think this is a psychological thing to explore here because to me it's fascinating because she does go, and she's slightly titillated by the fact that he has the guts or the balls or the incredible stupidity to take her to a porn movie on a first date. And it's a four. So to him, in his mind, he might actually be taking her to something a little more elevated because it's in Swedish or it's foreign, and you know, and it's an exploration of sexuality. They even mentioned Kinsey in the voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this an exploration of sexuality or is this a porn film? I don't know. But those Mondo films came out around this time as well, right? All those weird little Mondo films. So maybe this was part of that.
Well, it's on the spectrum.
Sure, I mean, sure.
Like, we're looking at a big, huge orgy.
Absolutely. But we're also seeing sex from the inside out.
Yeah, no, there's some weird, because so we're like on cells. And,
yeah, it's, you know, very it's European.
Definitely.
Okay, but when she walks out, but her reaction is so harsh. It's like, why did you buy the ticket? Or why did you let him buy the ticket? Why did you sit down? Did you not know you were walking into? You're more intelligent than Travis is. You knew what the fuck you were walking into. So when you flip out, I think what it is that Travis revealed this, like, what's the word? Ugly underbelly that she has. This fascination with this kind of dirtier parts of her life or the dirty parts of sex. And she was ashamed of how deep he got her to look at it and then stormed out. That's my opinion. It could be very surface that she was just offended and she left. But I just don't buy that she would be like, oh, you're taking me to a dirty movie. Oh. And then, or I don't go to these places usually. And then she goes, sits down. And only when she starts to see what she's watching or sees the stuff that she does, she have a harsh reaction and storm out. She doesn't give him a chance to apologize. She doesn't give him a chance. Like, she even insults the album. Keep it. I have it already. Like, it's just so harsh that I think he exposed something in her that she didn't want to be aware that she had inside.
I think there's a lot going on here. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where this movie gets into things that most movies don't.
Yes.
Which is that people are complicated. Mm-hmm. I think she has multiple feelings. I think she is insulted mm-hmm. that she would he would think to take her to a place like this. I think part of her is going, I'm going to be polite. I think there's that is okay. happening in there. And I think I've never seen a thing like this. Maybe this right. is, well, maybe I am a girl who likes things like this. Maybe this is a thing mm-hmm. I've always been curious about. And then she gets in there and they walk in the middle of the movie.
They do.
You know, like he it is not, and she pretty quickly goes, no, this, and the other thing yeah. is they're surrounded by men,
yeah.
you know, who may or may not be masturbating.
Sure.
You know, like this is not the right place for her. And she goes out and then she's trying to establish whether or not she was or wasn't titillated. I think she's trying to establish her, you know, her strength and her,
yeah.
you know, boundaries.
Yeah.
The other thing, by the way, that I think is interesting is we just saw a scene where a guy physically pulled someone out of a cab.
Right.
And now he is physically trying to restrain her from getting in a cab.
Yeah.
And it's really a strange parallel that's happening mm-hmm. back to back.
That's great.
And I want to say the thing, and I'm gonna come to this quote multiple times because I don't want to say the whole quote right now, but this is what Paul Schrader said about mm-hmm. what's going on in this film. He says, the girl he desires, he can't have, and the girl he can have, he can't desire.
Right.
Ooh,
what a terrible place to be.
Yeah. And that both Schrader and Scorsese says that he takes her to this movie on purpose mm-hmm. to take the, because there's a Madonna whore thing going sure. on in this film.
Right.
And he takes the Madonna to destroy her, essentially, you know, to sully her. He sees the purest person he's ever seen in the white dress. And where mm-hmm. does he take her? Takes her to a porn movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about he puts her on a pedestal and then he wants to bring her down to his world.
Yeah, and maybe this is, and of course, we are analytical people, so maybe this is a subconscious revenge moment for her making him feel kind of stupid in the cafe.
Maybe. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, and then he says this thing, it's like, well, this is the only place I know that we go.
Yeah, I don't know these other movies. I can take you to another, take you someplace else.
I don't know anything about other places, yeah, but I can take you there. Which is, we've already said, Travis Bickle is not the most worldly of people.
No.
But you would have think that he would have been to a movie.
Sure.
That was not porn.
And if nothing else, he would talk to somebody, maybe Peter Boyle or his boys, be like, hey, I got this date with this girl. Where should I take her?
Yeah.
Right? What movie can I take? What's a good movie to take her to?
The answer is sometimes Sweet Susan. That is the best. You got to take her there. I'm telling you, it's a great movie.
Yeah, that's
movie.
Of course another question too, Steve. How the fuck did he find this place? Like, how the fuck did he find this theater and this movie? What was it about this theater and this movie that was said to him?
Martin Scorsese is the director.
Yeah, that's fair.
He
that's
knows
fair.
Everything there is about movies. He calls her up.
Listen, I'm sorry about the other night. I didn't know that was the way you felt about it. Well, I didn't know that was the way you felt. I would have taken you somewhere else.
And again, it's a fascinating shot.
Yeah.
He's on this shot. It's flat space, which means there's no depth to the shot. Mm-hmm. And he's on the phone. It's three-quarter profile, so which means he's looking, or one-quarter profile. So he's looking kind of away, and he's off of the center of the frame.
Yeah.
Everything about this shot is not how you would do it. We never really see his face. And in the middle of this conversation that is, by the way, I think it's nice that she even picked up the phone, you know.
I've got another theory, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, and all I was going to say is in mm-hmm. the middle of the conversation, the camera just moves
yeah.
off him
yeah.
and looks down an empty hallway.
Mm-hmm.
What's your other theory about
that? He's not talking to her.
Oh.
That's my theory. Is that
well, then why is she being mean to him?
He's creating it all in his head. It's wow. his own art. It's his own subconscious. Like, this is the beginning of the snapping of him in becoming wow. Travis Bickle, because the shot veering off, Steve, yeah. is so it's an empty hallway.
Yeah.
Nothing's there.
You know what? I think it's a totally supportable theory.
Yeah, I'm sure Scorsese would be like, no, Rocco's an idiot if he ever even says my name out of his mouth. But like, in my feeling,
he would say.
It's like,
you know, by the way, if I could get a recording of Martin Scorsese saying Roca's an idiot, he should never say my name out of his mouth. That would make my day.
It would be my ringtone.
Every cinephiles from all time.
It would just open the cinephiles
and fuck Steve Morris. Can we have him say that too?
Let me tell you, Roca's an idiot. He's never going to say my name.
By the way, I was watching it. I will get back to the movie in a sec. But I was watching one of the behind the scenes, this interview with Martin Scorsese today, fairly recently. So he's, older, but his eyebrows are still dark black.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I suddenly just started staring at his eyebrows, which move completely independently, constantly.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stop laughing.
He's Groucho Marx.
I've never seen eyebrows do. I couldn't listen to what he was saying because it's like his eyebrows, each one had its own life.
I think I would, the hell I would feel, joy and hell at the same time. Heaven and hell, I guess, would be if I was caught in a conversation between Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, geez.
The speed of that conversation would destroy me, yet I would get so much information out of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think because of the empty hallway, he later on he confronts her and he says, I called you. Why don't you pick up? And he says he talks about calling her multiple times.
Yeah.
She only picked up the one time and she won't come to the phone. I think he's creating that whole conversation in his head because he knows he fucked this up with her, and now starts the break. The one angelic creature that he was able to find in this cesspool of people rejected him. It's so harshly too.
And rejected sometimes Sweet Susan, which I think she really didn't give a chance to.
That's right. It's a cinematic masterpiece in Sweden. It's the highest grossing film in Sweden. But so when the empty hallway, that's what I think what Scorsese does, this very crafty, deft move that would seem out of place, but I think he's kind of indicating he's not talking to anybody.
Well, I'll tell you something that I think might support your theory is that the next thing, he talks about sending her all these flowers.
Yeah.
And the next we see in his apartment, and all the flowers are in the apartment. And I'm like, well, did you send her the flowers?
Right.
Why are they all here?
I also sent flowers, but with no luck. The smell of the flowers only made me sicker. The headaches got worse. I think I got stomach cancer.
And there's something, by the way, as he talks about the flower, they're all drying and wilting and rotting. He says the smell of the flowers is making him feel sick, and it kind of makes me feel sick. It's very evocative the way that shot is done.
Yeah, it's symbolic too. His mind's deteriorating.
I shouldn't complain, though. You're only as healthy. You're only as healthy as you feel. You're only as healthy as you feel.
Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of part one of our discussion of Martin Scorsese's classic, Taxi Driver. If you want to comment on the film, the best place to do it is on our Facebook page. Just search for The Cinephiles, CINE-FILES. As always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or YouTube, Stitcher, TuneIn. Please leave your reviews on iTunes. They really help people find the show. And leave your comments on YouTube. We love interacting with you there. If you want to suggest a movie, you can do it through our Patreon page, patreon.com/TheCinephiles. And if you want to purchase or stream any of the films we've ever reviewed, including Taxi Driver, the best place to do it is through our website, cinephiles.net. That's CINE-FILES.net. As always, you can reach me on Twitter at SR Morris, and you can reach John on Twitter and on Instagram at The Roca Says. So that's it for this week, and we will see you next week for part two of Taxi Driver.